Michael, you've been teaching a course called Justice, and you had by now 14,000 or so Harvard undergraduates take it, which I'm told is more than any other course taught at Harvard. And now you've been branching out. Your lectures have been produced as a PBS series, and you've also produced a book, which is our topic tonight. Like the course, it is called Justice, and the subtitle is What's the Right Thing to Do? Give us a preview. What is the core idea behind this? What have you written about?
Well, it's about, John, how different of the famous philosophers have thought about justice and rights and the common good, but it approaches those philosophers in a way that tries to be inviting and accessible to citizens everywhere who care about public life. And so it approaches political philosophy, these big questions about values, by starting with the moral dilemmas and the political controversies that we argue about every day. So whether it's health care, which we've been arguing about in recent months, or bonuses and bailouts, or arguments about the ethics of torture, or affirmative action, or same-sex marriage, or income distribution. People have, ordinary citizens have, strong, passionate views, powerful convictions on these questions. And so what the book tries to do is really very much what I try to do in the course, which is to start with those concrete controversies where people have opinions and convictions, and then to show how those arguments, rumbling just beneath the surface of those arguments, are big questions about justice that we can reflect about deliberately once we see them.
Those big questions of justice, you have mentioned in connection with President Obama. You've said that in the past, when he was campaigning to become president, that he was very adept, in contrast to most other political candidates, in invoking a moral dimension to issues before us. And more recently, you've also noted that now that he has become president,
yes,
he's entangled in all those issues and all that a president has to do every day, that he is not as successful at taking the discussion to that higher plane. Does it concern you that the president might be losing his moral voice?
Well, I think it's true that during the campaign, one of the things that was so inspiring about Obama, the candidate, is that he was able to speak to, I think, a widespread yearning, a hunger for a better kind of political discourse, for a more elevated civic discourse that connected with moral and even spiritual questions. In recent decades, the whole idea of bringing moral and spiritual dimensions into politics was seen by many as something that only conservatives did, the cultural conservatives or the Christian conservatives. And this goes back to the 1980s. Many liberals and progressives said, we don't want controversial moral questions, certainly not spiritual questions in politics, because that will lead to intolerance and coercion. We disagree about these things. So let's steer clear of those. Let's try to have a politics that is neutral with respect to these contentious moral questions. And I think one of the strengths of candidate Obama is that he made the case for a progressive political vision that did talk about the meaning of justice and that connected with moral and spiritual questions. And he pointed out, going back to Martin Luther King, the debate over civil rights and against segregation, Martin Luther King drew on moral and even spiritual arguments. Going back to the abolitionists in the 1830s, some of the early abolitionists were evangelical Christians who argued that slavery is a sin. So he said progressives need not cut themselves off, need not cede a monopoly to conservatives on moral and spiritual questions. And that was a great source of strength, even inspiration. It's been hard for him, I think, as president, to translate that moral energy into governance. I think partly because he took office under pressure of the financial crisis, had to deal with that, and with Afghanistan and with health care. I think recently on health care, he's caught his moral stride and has been able to articulate the case for health care in moral terms, which I think is the only way of succeeding in getting universal health care. To talk about it in technocratic terms, as a matter of bending the cost curve, as he and others sometimes say, I don't think can inspire the public to support what is, after all, a bold ambition undertaking in American politics, finally to achieve some form of national health care, universal health care. So I think he has begun to find again the moral voice that resonated so powerfully in the campaign, but it has not been easy for him to translate that moral energy, that stirring rhetoric, into governance. I think he's still trying to find his way in that respect.
Turning to a subject that is on our minds a lot these days, Afghanistan, one of the things that I remember vividly from reading your book was a story that you told, a true story, about a group of special forces soldiers who encountered a group of unarmed goat herds in Afghanistan.
Yes.
Could you relate that?
Yes, these were U.S. Special Forces, Navy SEALs, four of them, who were in the mountains on the border of Afghanistan and Pakistan, and looking for a Taliban leader in one of the villages below. No sooner had they taken up their position that two Afghan goat herders with a flock of goats came upon them by accident, discovered their whereabouts. And so the soldiers discussed among themselves, what do we do with these goat herders? If we let them go back to the village, there's a strong likelihood that they will tell the Taliban that we are here, and our mission and our lives will be imperiled. So they debated this. Do we kill them? After all, these are civilians. They're unarmed. How can we kill them? They wrestled with this. They voted. And in the end, they decided, by the vote of one person, because one had abstained, to let them go. An hour or so later, the Special Forces team was surrounded by over 100 heavily armed Taliban. There was a fierce firefight. All but one of the Special Forces group was killed, and a rescue helicopter with 11 on board was shot down. So one survived, managed to roll down the mountain injured, and was rescued and protected in a Pashtun village till the rescue came. And he regretted this. He thought he had made the wrong decision. And yet it's a classic case. It's a wrenching moral dilemma. It's a classic case of a kind that philosophers have discussed for many, many years. Do you sacrifice? Do you take these two lives, even though they're unarmed, for the sake of protecting a greater number of lives and the mission? Or are there certain things that are just plain wrong to do, even if the consequences could be grave? In this story, it's an actual story, but it's one way of introducing in the book one approach to justice, which is the utilitarian idea of justice, which says justice means seeking the greatest overall happiness for the greatest number. And then the question arises, a challenge for utilitarian ideas, are numbers the only thing that count morally? Or there are certain acts, like killing those goat herders, unarmed, that are wrong regardless of the consequences?
Well, that example is certainly useful in a classroom because it is so complex and so wrenching. But are you, as someone who thinks these things through professionally, have you reached a decision as to whether they did the right thing?
Wow. You're tougher than my students, John.
All right.
Well, the answer I give to the students... No, I'll try to answer it. The answer I give to the students is At this point in the semester, we're trying, and at this chapter in the book, what I'm trying to do is to lay out the strongest possible case for the main philosophical alternatives, the competing approaches to justice, in this case, the utilitarian one, and then to develop the most powerful criticism. By the end of the book, and by the end of the semester, I do say what I think, because I really don't think it's possible to be a good teacher, or for that matter, to write a book that hopes to contribute to public discussion, democratic discourse, without ultimately saying where you stand. So, without giving away too much of the suspense, I would say that I don't think that utilitarianism is an adequate theory of justice. I think that simply adding up pain and pleasure, suffering and satisfaction, the utilitarian cost-benefit analysis, it's a moral calculus, a cost-benefit analysis, I don't think that that is the whole of justice. I do think there are certain fundamental principles of justice, including respect for human rights, that should not yield to a strictly utilitarian calculus. So there I've come clean, John.
Pretty clean.
But the reasons, that it's a longer story and it's played out in the book and in the course.
You mentioned the utilitarian way of looking at moral questions. And as I understand the book, you discuss these cases, these dilemmas that people find themselves in, and you show them through three lenses. One is the utilitarian view.
Yes.
And the second is the system of justice that puts a high value on freedom and individual rights. And the third is the one that celebrates virtue and morality and religion.
And the common good.
And the common good.
Right.
With that in mind, I'd like to ask you about a current issue in our public life, and that is whether it's justified to use torture on suspected terrorists. Can you talk about that?
Sure. Well, torture also raises the classic utilitarian question. If you look at the defense that former Vice President Cheney has made of torture and of waterboarding, he has made a classic utilitarian argument. He has said, look, it may be terribly disagreeable to torture a terrorist suspect, but it's justified, he says, because it saves thousands, maybe tens of thousands of lives. That's his claim. Now, in the public argument about the ethics of torture, there are two ways of challenging that idea. Some have disputed that it really is effective. And that's a practical consideration. That's very important. But there's also a moral argument that can be raised against his case for torture. And it's a moral argument that points to the possible limits or defect in utilitarian moral reasoning. It may be that even if it's true that we get valuable information that saves lives, that it's nonetheless wrong to torture. And here's a way of testing that idea. Are numbers the only thing that count morally? Imagine that the only way to get the information you needed to save all those lives was not to torture the terrorist suspect, let's say that didn't work, but to torture his 12-year-old daughter. Suppose that would work. Suppose that would save those lives. Would you do it? Would it be the right thing to do? I suspect that even those who are tempted by utilitarian reasoning in the first torture case would hesitate. And I think the reason that most people would hesitate, and maybe even Vice President Cheney would hesitate, you'd have to ask him. If you have him on this program, John, you can put it to him, is that what's doing the moral work in his argument for torturing the terrorist suspect is a non-utilitarian idea of justice. Namely, we think this is a pretty bad guy, who deserves rough treatment, independent of the utilitarian consequences. But when it's the daughter who's innocent, she doesn't deserve rough treatment, and so most people would hesitate, which suggests that even those who think that the torture case provides a powerful argument for utilitarian moral reasoning are really resting on another idea of justice, which is drawn from the third idea you mentioned, the idea that justice means giving people their due, giving people what they deserve, according to their virtue, or to their bad character in the case of the terrorist. That idea is doing a lot of the moral work in the terrorism defense, I think.
Lately, we've been hearing a lot of the laments about the poor quality of public discourse,
yes,
political discourse in America. And there are many examples we could cite. The means by which we communicate publicly have changed quite a bit lately,
right,
notably because of the internet. And literally millions of citizens have been able to join in the public discourse, and although they've been forever excluded. What we've got now, perhaps as a partial result of that, perhaps not connected, is a public discussion that is often angry, often cynical, often based on talking points,
right,
which are predetermined regardless of where the discussion's leading, and polarizing. All this has been noted. Give us your perspective on that. As someone who is an advocate of enlightened public discourse,
right,
how bad is it? How does it compare with other times in our history? Is it as bad as it seems, or is it always pretty bad?
It's bad. In a word, I think that what passes for political deliberation these days essentially consists of shouting matches on cable television and ideological food fights on the floor of Congress. Now, I'm not suggesting that there was once a golden age of purely elevated and enlightened public discourse. Politics has always been rife with interests, with special pleading, and with demagoguery. There was a time when a senator was beaten with a cane on the floor of the Senate back in the 19th century. So I'm not suggesting that there was a golden age, but there have been times, even in our lifetimes, when political argument has gone better, when it's been less shallow, less bitter, less divisive than today. I think the reason has partly to do with the factor that you mentioned, John, changes in the nature of the media. When you were the editor of the Los Angeles Times and of the Baltimore Sun, newspapers were instruments of civic education. They told people what they wanted to know about, but newspapers also helped teach people about what they ought to know about and care about. That's what I mean by being instruments of civic education. They weren't simply catering to the consumer preferences of people. My worry now is that when more and more people get their information either from late night comedy shows, which is where a lot of young people get their information, their news, or through very narrow cast internet access. People go for the fact or the news item they're looking for and don't stumble across news accounts by inadvertence that they should read about and learn about, as was the case with newspapers. When I was growing up, I loved watching the evening news. And I tried to catch all of the network evening newscasts if I could, back in the days of Walter Cronkite. I wanted to be, you remember Eric Severide?
Sure.
Commentator. I wanted to be Eric Severide when I grew up. I thought, you know, his Olympian commentaries on the news, I thought that was fascinating. And I loved watching it. I was a political junkie. But even network news, to say nothing of the great newspapers, were instruments of real civic education. They weren't seen yet as profit centers for big corporations who had to be primarily concerned with ratings. So I think the change in the media has contributed to the degradation of political discourse and of civic education. But I also think that politicians and the political parties bear some of the responsibility. I don't think we should let them off the hook either. And so what I've tried to do, or what I'm hoping with the book in a modest way, is to try to prompt a different kind of public deliberation, a different kind of civic discourse, which engages more directly with the big moral questions and questions of justice and the common good that people do care about and that underlie the positions that we take when we argue about politics, but that rarely find expression, rarely come to the surface. The parties and the politicians are not doing a good job of articulating the broader moral questions or creating a framework for moral argument and debate about social justice. And yet people do care about these things. And I think there is a great hunger abroad in the land for a better, more demanding kind of politics that connects with big civic themes and larger questions of justice and the common good. That's what I sense, and that's what I'm hoping in a small way to contribute to.
Back before you were successful in elevating yourself to a higher moral plane, you were a newspaper man. Congratulations on having achieved escape velocity. And I know that you covered Watergate. How was the tone? That was a period of national trauma. How was the tone of the debate then compared with what we're experiencing now?
Right. Well, I confess that I wanted to be Eric Severide when I grew up. And when I was 21, between my junior and senior year in college, I applied to a whole bunch of newspapers looking for a job as a summer intern because I loved politics. And I was offered a job for the summer at the Houston Chronicle in their Washington bureau. I'd never been to Houston, but here was a chance to go to Washington in the summer of 1974. I was 21 years old at the time. And this was the summer of the impeachment of Richard Nixon, when the whole Watergate debate was going on. So I leapt at the opportunity. It was a fantastic experience. It was a small bureau. And so they let me sit in the House Judiciary Committee impeachment hearings, in the Supreme Court arguments about the Nixon tapes case, whether he would have to give over the tapes. It was an amazing experience, and I got to write about these incredible events. And reporting for the Houston paper, we had a special responsibility to cover Barbara Jordan, who was the Houston congresswoman, on the impeachment committee, the House Judiciary Committee. And I remember at the end, the evening, that the committee voted Article I of impeachment. As they went, called the roll, and each member voted, A or nay, it was with trembling voices. There was not the partisanship that we would see a generation later during the Clinton impeachment, but there was a sense of constitutional moment and sobriety and even reverence for the Constitution and the burden as they experienced it, as a historic burden. And when the vote finished and the hearing was gaveled to a close, as you know, John, all the reporters then rush up toward the front to interview the members of Congress. And I went to Barbara Jordan because I had responsibility for her, and I asked probably a silly question like, how do you feel at a moment like this? And she snapped at me, and she said, with tears in her eyes, she said, I don't want to talk to anybody about how I feel right now. And she left. And I was shaken. But it stuck with me because it conveyed the sense of gravity and conscientiousness and constitutional, a sense of history that was so different from the partisan tone and spirit that we saw with the Clinton impeachment and that we see in Congress today. So even then, which is just a generation ago, the tone was very different.
You used a phrase in reference to newspapers. You described them as instruments of civic education. Do you have thoughts about other instruments, for example, the public schools?
Yes.
Should they be telling us or teaching our children what they should appreciate in public life and what it means and what the values are? I know when I went to school, public school, we had classes called civics, and
yes,
they told us what our duties were as citizens,
right.
And
right.
I still remember some of those
right.
things they taught me.
Right.
Is that an important element of what we're getting at?
I think it is. I think that the public schools have an enormous role to play in fostering a better, richer civic life. I don't think the public schools should teach students what to think or what values to embrace. I think they should teach students how the government works, how democracy works. They should cultivate in students a sense of civic responsibility to participate as citizens. And that means that they have to be informed so they can participate well and effectively. I think the public schools, as part of that civic education, should teach American history, and for that matter, world history, so there is some factual basis for the exercise of civic responsibility. And then ideally, in colleges and universities, students should have another, broader kind of civic education, which goes beyond the inculcation of civic duties and responsibilities and helps students grapple with some of the big questions about values and justice and the meaning of freedom, competing conceptions of the common good, the kind of things that the book is addressed to, big questions of political philosophy, moral philosophy, as they bear on public life and public questions, so that students will become equipped to be effective participants in a better kind of public debate. So I think the public schools have a role. I think colleges and universities have a role. I think we need to refashion the way newspapers, and especially television and the media, contribute to or frame public discourse. And I think politicians and political parties need to be challenged to do better. So across those different institutions of social life, I think we have a lot of work to do to try to repair and elevate the terms of civic discourse and political deliberation.
Let's turn to your career as a teacher. As I noted earlier, you've taught 14,000 people in this one course. You've taught other courses. And respectfully, I'd like to say that I think you're teaching it backward. When I went to college, which was before you were teaching, we were given texts to read, assigned readings. We had to read Aristotle, and we had to read Plato, and we had to read Kant. And it was pretty daunting. They were hard. They're very abstract and hard to understand.
Right.
And also lost largely on me was why I needed to know this. You seem to be doing it the other way around. You're actually making the course about the concerns that we all have in our public lives and in our individual lives.
Right.
And then you sort of lead back to what the great thinkers of the past have told us.
Yes.
And make those immediate concerns of ours seem universal and transcendent. Why do you do that?
Well, first, I will plead guilty to teaching backwards in just the way you described. In fact, when I was a freshman in college, I took one of the courses like you described, John, and tried to read Plato and Aristotle, and I couldn't make any sense of it. It was very dry and abstract.
That makes me feel better.
And so I went back to being a political junkie and studying about politics and history and economics, and only in graduate school did I turn back to political philosophy. And so when I started teaching, I tried to design a course that would have interested me back then when I was a college freshman. And so I begin with concrete cases, controversies, legal and political dilemmas that we argue about today and care about, elicit the views of students or of readers about those questions, whether affirmative action or same-sex marriage or the gap between rich and poor or taxation for redistribution or bailouts or torture, as we've discussed, or health care. Starting with those cases, which are concrete and which tap into the moral convictions and opinions that people have, gives you a starting point for critical reflection. I think one of the reasons students are drawn to this enterprise is there is something exhilarating about critically reflecting on one's own moral and political convictions. Here is a chance to figure out what we believe and why. And I've found in talking with citizens generally, people generally, adults, not just students, about the book, there's a similar hunger. Now, grown-ups tend to be more formed, more fixed than undergraduates in their views. But still, I think there's a great hunger for engaging with these hard moral questions. Now, doing it backwards, in a way, has a good precedent for it. When political philosophy was invented by Socrates in ancient Athens, he did it by starting with concrete questions and working from there, drawing people out. When Aristotle wrote about political philosophy, he said it's important to start in the city with the opinions people have. It's a starting point. There is a way. I mean, Plato has this image of the cave. The philosopher is a figure in the cave, and most of us just look at the shadows on the wall in the cave. We never see the real thing, except a few philosophers escape from the cave and can see the sun. And then the challenge is to coax them back in the cave to govern, because they've seen the way things really are. But I think that's not quite the way to think about philosophy. I think the claims of the cave have to be given their due. The opinions and convictions of ordinary citizens, even the ones who call in to talk radio and say maybe not very considered things.
Well,
there's
put.
Something to learn. There's something still to learn from that as a starting point. I listen to right-wing talk radio sometimes. I do. I find it interesting. I love NPR, I love C-SPAN, I love PBS, but I do listen sometimes to right-wing talk shows on the radio, not because I find it agreeable or edifying, but because it's a way of trying to understand what's moving people, and often outrage, which is what one hears a lot of. Outrage is an interesting form of anger. It's anger at injustice, or what people take to be injustice. Moral outrage, even kind of crude though it may sometimes be in its expression, I think we can learn from that. It's the grist. It's the starting point. It's a crucial ingredient, I think, for philosophy.
You use the phrase right-wing talk shows. Isn't that redundant? Aren't they all right-wing? Or virtually all?
Well,
and if so, why?
If so, why? I don't think they are all right-wing, but I agree with you that probably a disproportionate number of the most prominent talk shows and some of the cable shows are right-wing. It's an interesting question why. Why liberals and progressives have not managed to develop a comparable presence in talk radio. And I'm not sure of the answer, but I have a hunch, which is, first, I think moral outrage is really the stock in trade of a certain kind of talk radio. It's bracing. It may be sometimes shocking. But moral outrage, liberals and progressives are a little bit wary of moral outrage. I think maybe too wary. Because, and in fact, I would go further. I think part of the reason that liberals and progressives from the 80s and the 90s up through the current decade have struggled politically is that they haven't attended as directly as conservatives have to the moral energy and passion and sometimes the spiritual energy that finds its way into sometimes harsh forms of public discourse. And I think that's partly because liberals and progressives tend to say, we don't want to get into moral and spiritual questions in politics because that will lead to intolerance and coercion. That's what cultural conservatives do, not us. That's what fundamentalists do, not us. I think that's a mistake. And I think part of the strength, going back to candidate Obama, one of the great strengths of his candidacy and one of the sources of his eloquence was that he connected with the moral and spiritual yearning and energy in the public, to connect with a public life of larger meaning that addressed big questions of social justice and the common good. It needn't be conservative, moral energy and passion in politics, but I think liberals and progressives sometimes forget that.
And do you think that the liberals and progressives who have failed to address things in these terms the way Obama has that been not only a tactical loss, but is it a loss to the nation?
Yes. And it hasn't always been this way. If you look back at the debates of the American public discourse in the 1950s and 60s, it tended to be progressives who drew most powerfully on moral and even faith-based arguments in politics. Martin Luther King is one example. His letter from a Birmingham jail was a letter addressed to fellow ministers and preachers, and it drew on his own Christian faith as he made an argument against segregation. He was not bashful, Martin Luther King, about bringing moral and even religious arguments to bear in politics. If you look at the protest against the Vietnam War and the moral energy that attended it, the moral energy was articulated by progressive political figures, including Robert Kennedy, who's a great hero of mine, and who in retrospect was leaning against this tendency in liberalism. And he thought, I think rightly, that to talk about justice is not only to talk about freedom of choice and individual rights. He thought it's also to talk about the common good and about the character of citizens, the habits and dispositions that we develop as citizens to care about the common good. And he connected this to talking about the good life. He said that a consumer society, a market-driven consumer society, is not the best way to live. It leads to impoverished citizens, morally impoverished, not just economically. So he was making arguments in the 1968 campaign before he was assassinated, along the lines that I'm suggesting. And what I'm suggesting, and to some extent Barack Obama has gestured toward this, that we need to revitalize and re-energize public discourse in a way that engages more directly and robustly with big questions of justice and moral themes.
Let's talk about markets.
Yes.
Your book deals in fairly small part with markets.
Yes.
And how they serve the public good or,
yes.
or fail to serve the public
right.
good. And I understand that your next book will be entirely about markets. So something about markets is on your mind, and you think that perhaps the rest of us should know about it. What is it about markets that you feel compelled to tell us about?
Right. Well, there is a way of thinking about justice that says the way to achieve a just society is to set up free markets where there are no coercion, where there is no coercion, where people freely exchange goods and services. And whatever distribution of income and wealth that markets produce is just. That's one theory of justice, a libertarian free market theory of justice. And in the book, I challenge that. I present that theory, but then raise some objections to it. Is it the case that whatever a free market produces in the way of distribution is just? I don't think so. Consider a straightforward example. The Chief Justice of the United States, John Roberts, makes what a year? A little over $200,000 a year. There's another judge who makes more than the Chief Justice. Judge Judy, the judge on television.
Yeah.
You know how much she makes? $25 million a year. Now, the market has produced that. She didn't steal it. Supply and demand has produced a society where we pay Judge Judy $25 million. Does anybody think that her contribution to the public good, whatever that contribution is, I'm not sure exactly, but whatever it is it really worth 100 times what the Chief Justice of the United States contributes? Or the average school teacher makes, what, about $42,000, $44,000 a year in this country. David Letterman makes, what, $31 million. Now, that's the market. But simply because the free market has produced that outcome, is there any reason to consider that outcome just? I would say no. I would say that it depends, that those market results depend on lots of morally contingent things that are not the doing of the people who reap these huge rewards. So that's one way of looking at the moral limits of markets from the standpoint of distributive justice. What's fair? Who deserves what? And should there be a redistribution of income and wealth? Or should the affluent be taxed to support social programs for the less affluent, or for that matter, that everyone can avail themselves of? That's one issue, distributive justice. Another moral limit question about the moral limits of markets has to do with whether there are certain things that should not be bought and sold for money. In the book, I discuss the question of military service. We have an all-volunteer military now, which means we allocate military service on a market principle. But we've gone beyond that with the market in military service. Right now, President Obama is making decisions about sending troops, more troops to Afghanistan. By 2007, in Iraq, there were more private military contractors than there were U.S. military troops. The same is true in Afghanistan, even after the increase in the number of U.S. troops. Now, this is a novel role for markets in recent times, essentially outsourcing war to private companies. Is that a good thing or a bad thing? Well, we should have a debate about it. And one of the things that's striking to me is that this happened, this fairly eventful change in the way we fight wars, the outsourcing, greater role for markets, without ever there being a real political debate, democratic debate, about whether we wanted to do this or not. It just seem to happen. So part of what I'm trying to do in this book and in future work is to prompt a public discussion about the legitimate role that markets play and should play, and a debate about the moral limits of markets. Are there certain goods, certain civic goods or other kinds of goods that should not be bought and sold on the market? That's a debate we haven't had, but I think that we should have.
A debate that we are having currently has to do with the compensation of CEOs.
Yes.
Tell me what you think about that issue. Why is it that people are so exercised other than envy? And and what should we do about that?
Well, we have had a flurry of debate about executive compensation, mostly in the wake of the financial crisis, when Wall Street firms and banks were bailed out with taxpayer money. And no sooner does that happen than that many of these companies are paying out huge bonuses. Companies that would have gone under but for the government bailout, the taxpayer subsidy. That generated outrage, justifiably so. And it's prompted some debate about executive compensation. But the debate that we've had has been fairly narrow. It's been tied to the objection that, hey, these guys are getting bonuses that are essentially coming as a result of the fact that the taxpayers kept the companies afloat. It hasn't really prompted a broader discussion about who deserves what and whether enormous executive compensation on Wall Street is justified in the first place, in the good years, never mind at times when there have been taxpayer subsidies. So, for example, today the ratio of CEO pay to the average worker is about 350-1, which means that the CEO of a big company makes, on average, in a day what the average worker makes in a year. Now, here's a question for justice. Is that fair? Some people say yes, because it's a reward for the effort and the talent of the CEOs. And if we didn't allow those levels of compensation, the argument goes the talent would leave. We need to retain them. But not long ago, in 1980, the ratio was not 350-1. It was 42-1. That raises an interesting question. Back in today, do those CEOs work eight times as hard as CEOs did in 1980? Not likely. Are they eight times smarter than CEOs were in 1980? Probably not. Eight times more talented? Not likely. Well, if that's the case, then the huge increase in the ratio of CEO pay can't be just explained by the talent and effort and the skill of the people who perform the jobs. It must have to do with bigger economic factors, to do with technology and globalization and the way the economy is organized, that are not the doing of the people who land on top. And if that's true, then there may be reason to question and to have a public debate about CEO compensation and also about the tax system in good times, not just in times like now when these companies have been bailed out by the taxpayer.
Let's put you in a position of being a political consultant now. Or rather a statesman's consultant. We don't want to deal with politicians. We want to create statesmen. What would be your counsel to President Obama at this point? What would you advise him if he were to seek your advice?
My first piece of advice would be that he should try to find a way to give expression in his presidency to the moral energy and the civic renewal that he stirred during the campaign. One way of putting this is to suggest, you know, Mario Cuomo said, we campaign in poetry, but govern in prose. I think that President Obama, in his first year, may have learned that lesson too well. So my advice to him would be to remember that where the presidency is concerned, you need to govern with some poetry alongside the prose and the policy, because the presidency is a position that requires moral leadership and that requires framing big public questions in moral and civic terms as part of the democratic project that President Obama so powerfully described during the campaign. It isn't easy to translate that stirring rhetoric and hope and civic promise into the hard business of governing. But I think if he's to be as great a president as he could be, he has to try to reconnect with the moral and civic and spiritual energy and eloquence of his campaign.
And on the other side of the aisle, what would your counsel be to the Republicans who are in the process of rebuilding their party, figuring out what they stand for, who they are? How would you suggest they go about that?
In much the same way, which is to is not to go for celebrity or gimmicks, but instead to try to have a debate about what it means to be a conservative, about what the Republican Party stands for, and in particular, to have a debate about the two great currents in modern conservatism, which fit uneasily together. One is the idea that conservatives stand for individualism and free markets. The other strand is that conservatives stand for bringing to bear cultural traditions, values, virtues to build and form civic character. And you had these, the conservative movement at its best has wrestled with the tension between these two approaches to politics. The individualist laissez-faire one and the one that we sometimes call cultural conservatives, the virtue strand of conservative thought. Conservatives at their best, or Republicans trying to rebuild their party, should reconnect with those two great currents of thought and try to see if there is a way for our time of reconciling them, or at least living creatively with the tension that those two strands produce. That would make, I think, for a richer public discourse coming from the conservative side, just as I think liberals and progressives have to undertake a similar project from their side.
One of the highly emotional issues that's been confusing to me in a way from an ideological point of view, because it seems to scramble some of the political ideologies and split coalitions, is gay marriage. You've written about that. Tell me why is this such a complex question?
Right. Well, I find it's a striking debate. There is a tendency among some defenders of same-sex marriage to say we should not get into the moral controversy about the meaning of marriage or about gay relationships and the moral state. We should avoid all of those arguments and simply argue for same-sex marriage on grounds that are morally neutral, at least with respect to those debates. Simply view it as a matter of non-discrimination, equal protection under the law. There's something very tempting about that way of approaching the question. But I think that's a bad way of framing it. that will not serve, that doesn't really capture what's at stake, and won't ultimately serve the political cause of same-sex marriage. I think it's what's really at stake in the debate over same-sex marriage is what forms of family union and what forms of personal relationship are worthy of respect and honor and recognition by the community. And what is the purpose? What are the moral and civic purposes of marriage? Is marriage primarily about procreation? Or is it also about mutual commitment and a lifelong commitment? And so I think that the case for same-sex marriage should not try to say that these moral questions have no place in politics, but instead should grapple directly with those questions about the purpose of marriage, the moral meaning of the family, and what sorts of family unions are worthy of respect and honor and recognition in the long term. Winning that argument will be much more important, I think, for the advocates of same-sex marriage than you could possibly achieve by saying, well, let's not get into that. Let's not try to change people's mind about those fundamental questions. Let's just try to say, no, this is about non-discrimination. Because on both sides, there's a sense that the meaning of marriage and the moral questions at stake really are what people are arguing about.
Lest anyone in our audience who hasn't read the book think that it deals solely with current affairs, that sort of things we're hearing about on television these days, I want to point out that Michael has come out in this book four square against cannibalism. Could you tell us what place cannibalism has in a discussion like this?
After this edifying discussion, you bring up cannibalism. It's actually a very interesting case. We've been talking here about one powerful theory of justice, which is the libertarian, individualist, free market approach to justice, which says whatever consenting adults agree to is just. So one way of testing that libertarian idea of justice is with a case that actually arose a few years ago in Germany, where it was among consenting adults. A guy put an ad on the internet looking for someone who would submit to consensual, to be cannibalized, case of consensual cannibalism. A lot of people answered the ad. And he developed a short list of contenders and had interviews, probably across a table like this, for all I know, and met with several of them. It was deliberate. It was thought through. It was not irrational. And he identified one candidate, and they agreed that they would engage in this cannibalistic, consensual act, and they carried it out. And the news accounts were grim and gruesome, and I don't even want to try to replicate them. It went to the courts in Germany, and they didn't know what to do with this case because there was no law against consensual cannibalism. In a way, it's a case of, you might call it extreme assisted suicide, which is what it was. So what to charge this man with? They first charged him with manslaughter, and he was given, I think, 5 or 6 years in prison. But there was an outrage against that, and a new trial was established, and eventually he was convicted to life in prison. Now, the reason I raise it in the book is that it's a test of the philosophical principle to see if you really think you're a libertarian. We could put this to Ron Paul, perhaps. If you really think you're a libertarian, these were consenting adults, would you permit that? That's the test. That's the role it plays in the book. But there's an interesting postscript to the story which is while in prison, this cannibal character became a vegetarian. And on the grounds that factory farming is unethical. Good grist for philosophy.
Michael, I think of you...
I shudder to think what's coming next.
No. I think of you primarily... I know you're a philosopher, you're a book author, you've been on television, but I think of you primarily as a teacher. And I've had the pleasure of attending your lectures, and my wife actually audited one of your courses, not Justice, but another course that you taught. And on the days when you were lecturing, which wasn't really a lecture, it was an engagement with students, I could count on the fact that when I got home and she got home that I would hear at least a half an hour on what Sandel did today. And some of it I can remember myself, so I have maybe a tenth of a Sandel course under my belt. But there really is, I think, a remarkable electricity that goes on in the classroom in a way that really does create a knowledge and insight that I seldom see anywhere else. So now that you're branching out, you're doing books, you're on television, how do you see your career unfolding from now on? Do you see yourself primarily as a teacher? Is that what you're going to be doing? Or do you have other plans?
Well, I think the role of a teacher can be directed to students, and it can also, especially in my field, which is political philosophy, it can also, that role can try to make a contribution to the larger public discourse. And so this book is part of that effort because it's addressed to people outside the academy, trying to make these ideas accessible and inviting and exciting and engaging. And as you mentioned before, Harvard did an experiment filming the entire course, and WGBH in Boston, the public television station, turned it into a 12-part public television series. And we've put it all online so that it's freely available. The first time an entire Harvard course has been made available free on the air and online to anyone, anywhere in the world who would like to follow it, including the course with the engagement back and forth with the students, who are an enormous part of this experiment, and with the readings, discussion guides, discussion blogs where people can participate in the discussion. And that people can see it on justiceharvard.org if they want to take a look. So the goal, it's really an experiment to see whether by opening up the classroom and putting out a book that is an invitation to political philosophy, to citizens generally, to see whether it's possible first to engage people in these discussions, but also maybe in the process, in a modest way, to help prompt a more morally engaged kind of public deliberation. I think in the end, to be a democratic citizen requires being something of a philosopher, which is why way back at the beginning of my subject, political philosophy, when it was invented, Socrates went wandering around the streets of Athens striking up conversations with the people he encountered. They were not people who had enrolled in his course. They didn't get course credit for the encounter, though maybe they should have. And so taking political philosophy out of doors, so to speak, that's what I'm trying to do. That's what we're trying to do with this project. And so I hope that it can contribute to a kind of public stirring of interest in the broader questions, the bigger questions that are present already in our political arguments, but are not articulated, that are kind of struggling to be heard, to find articulation just beneath the surface. So that's what I'd like to try to do.
And do you foresee a time when the lectures at Harvard, for example, would be broadcast or transmitted by the web to the entire world, free perhaps? If you're in a village in China or a village in Bangladesh, you could get maybe not the entirety of a Harvard education free, but if you're smart enough and diligent enough, you could get a pretty good hunk of it. Is that likely to happen?
I'd like to think so. And what we've done here, and Harvard made this commitment to do an experiment with the Justice course, to put it out there free to anyone, anywhere in the world. And I've been told that in the first few weeks even that it's been up online, people from 162 different countries have looked at the lectures. And I would like to think that the great colleges and universities of the United States will make use of this new technology to open the classroom experience to everyone, partly as a public service, but also as a way of furthering the educational mission itself. What I would one day like to see, John, is not only that people from China and India and Europe and Africa look at these lectures and wrestle with these questions and debate online, but that maybe we can create a kind of global classroom where students in Delhi or in Cape Town or in Shanghai can engage, having studied some of these questions, maybe with their own professors, and read John Stuart Mill and Aristotle, and maybe looked at some of these materials, would engage in conversation and discussion with my students in Sanders Theater in Cambridge, Massachusetts, and think how much we could learn from their responses coming from different cultural backgrounds. How do they view debates about distributive justice and the gap between rich and poor and affirmative action and torture and health care? And maybe there are big, important questions that they wrestle with that we haven't thought of and that we could learn from, and maybe also their philosophical traditions. So I think that this is really an exciting possibility. Not only that we're providing a public service by dispensing whatever we've created, but that we learn from the reception and from the contributions of those who may choose to take it up in different societies, aiming toward a kind of global classroom, but maybe ultimately a kind of global public square. That would be my ultimate hope and vision.
So I have a question that I rashly said to you today I wasn't going to ask you. But in journalism, in the moral code of journalism, a bait and switch is only a misdemeanor. So coming on with you, I read a number of articles about you. And there's one unanswered question. And that is this. It is said, but never confirmed, that you are the model for the character called Mr. Burns in The Simpsons.
In The Simpsons.
Some people may know this. Michael, of course, is regarded as a voice of ethical behavior and propriety. And Mr. Burns is the man in The Simpsons who runs the local nuclear power plant.
And he's an awful character.
Horrible.
Yeah. Isn't
he has no qualms about poisoning the environment, degrading the whole city, stealing, whatever. And that it is said that people who took your justice course now work on The Simpsons, and as a joke, thought they would draw Mr. Burns to look just like you. Is there anything to it?
I certainly hope not. The honest answer is I don't know. It's an urban legend that's plagued me for many years. And I hope there's no resemblance whatsoever.
Well, I intend to watch The Simpsons again soon to check it out. Michael, in light of some of our discussion of these three themes of justice, I'd like your take on the question that comes up again and again and again of reparations to African Americans for what was done to them in slavery. Where does that stand? Where is that headed? And what are the rights and the wrongs there?
Right. Well, I take it up in the book as a way of getting at a hard philosophical question, which is, what is the nature of responsibility? When there was when the debate about reparations first arose in Congress some years ago, at least in its recent round, there were some who opposed the idea in principle, saying, I never owned any slaves, so how can I be held, or for that matter, people of this generation, be held morally responsible for an injustice that was perpetrated generations ago? That claim raises a hard question about moral responsibility and justice. Is it ever possible to have moral responsibilities that we inherit from previous generations? There's not an obvious answer to that question. If you believe in a certain individualist theory of justice, then the answer is no. Then the answer is, I have only those moral obligations that I myself have willingly incurred. But if you believe that some of our moral and political obligations derive from our sense of belonging, of being members in a political community that extends across time, then it's certainly possible to speak about there being collective responsibilities that may include an obligation to set right injustice committed in our name in a previous generation. Now, I think there is something to this second way of thinking about moral responsibility. Because if we reject it in principle, it's very difficult to make sense even of what it is to take pride in one's country and its traditions, which, after all, is a conservative impulse, as much as it may be a liberal impulse. How can we take pride in what they did back then? The founders, or the framers of the Constitution, or Lincoln at Gettysburg, how can we take pride in the past of our country if we are in principle incapable of taking responsibility for injustices that may have been perpetrated by our forebears? So, in a way, this gets back to a fundamental question about whether moral obligation arises and moral responsibility arises only from the individual acts and choices that we make, or whether obligation has something to do with solidarity, membership, belonging, and a sense of participating in a community extended over time. Now, that doesn't tell us alone whether there should be reparations for slavery or what form it should take. But it does open up the possibility morally of a debate about reparations. And I think that's a debate that we should have. Now, if you take the communal understanding of responsibility, it might be that the form that reparations should take should be communal, not one by one, but to communal institutions of various kinds. But this issue of responsibility and how we incur obligations, only as individuals or as members of a community, that debate, I think, is one that we should have as we consider the question of reparations. And by the way, it's not only a debate that has confronted the United States. Across the country, across the world, there have in recent decades been debates about reparations and public apologies, official apologies, to Native peoples, to the Aboriginal peoples in Australia, for example. They've had debates about this. So the individual versus the communal understanding and moral responsibility is one that is very much of the moment around the world.
Well, Michael, I appreciate your being here. We're out of time, but I want to say that there's nothing I would rather do than come up to Harvard and take your course, but since I can't do that, this has been the next best thing.
Thank you, John, so much. Thank you very much.